The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 172. This is another of our Worldcon episodes. You already know the drill about the audio, so I won't say that. I will just mention really quick that this episode begins right in the middle of a conversation, although the point at which I've cut it, it starts at the beginning of a story that is part of that conversation. You aren't missing anything, but you'll notice it just starts right off in mid-sentence. So there you go. So enjoy the episode, and thank you for listening.
Delete what you don't want.
All right.
My rate is 75 an hour.
So I was on this panel, and there was a guy there from the Middle East, and he said they did a study that looked at the amount of science fiction being published every year and the number of patents put out by those countries. And the only place where they were zero and zero is the Middle East. So he is...
But what was the star... what was his name?
I don't know.
Okay. We can check the Lone Star programming. So.
But he was saying that they're trying to introduce science fiction into the Middle East because they're trying to see if they can improve that ratio.
Innovation.
Which was interesting because he said basically, let's do this panel again in 20 years and then we'll be able to tell if they have that impact or not.
I wonder if it was Yasser.
It was Yasser, right? I couldn't remember his name.
Banjat, I think, was his last name.
A website that he just started, and I guess sort of a conglomeration.
Sure.
But for that purpose, and forums, and trying to just open up. His comment was at the beginning of the panel we went to that you missed was that people don't even know that the genre exists, even if they're writing it potentially. They don't even know that science fiction as a genre exists. So trying, somehow encouraging them to come out and find each other is what he's trying to do. Yeah. So we're trying to hook up with them for next year because next year we're doing this whole sort of global tour of authors.
So you're going
we're not actually going anywhere, but
I'm going to try. But financially, that's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, so. Right. Well, just so you know, the week after that is like this Leprechaun science fiction convention in Dublin,
right? Which is where they're hosting on purpose because they're bidding for 2019 for Dublin, Ireland. Yeah, and if you've seen the brochure, they have this like folder size fold out brochure back in front. It's gorgeous. Yeah. I mean, they're gonna get it. If they don't get it, I'll be pissed because it looks amazing. And there's even like a whole section about how the government will actually offer some financial support for the convention if it goes.
Well, Ireland needs anything that they can get right now in terms of economic boost.
Well, sure, but it would be also just really great because I can't think of, has WorldCon ever gone to Ireland?
Not that I'm aware of.
I mean, it may have at like some point way back in the distant past.
Yeah, Scotland.
Okay,
so. World Fantasy.
That may have been, I don't know, but.
This is my first Spanish convention, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it'd be good to have it go there. And I mean, that's really.
I go to gaming conventions.
Gaming convention. You're a loser.
No, I'm not.
Just teasing.
That's my first convention ever. Was Gen Con 1982.
I'm still trying to win my way there. Third place in a Catan tournament. So close.
Don't do that.
You can play Catan online. Hone your skills.
You paid to.
You got third place, huh?
Third place.
You're really good. I will never play with you that game.
Ever. A little bit angry. But yeah, no, we could do it. We have a whole family thing going to KublaCon.
See, Catan is like, to me, it's like Monopoly. After a while, you have to have people who are willing to trade with you.
Oh, yeah, you know.
And some people are just jerks.
It is. It's absolutely crucial. It is a very social game, which is part of the reason that I love it.
If you're competitive, see.
You know, and it's interesting because you see people who refuse to trade, and they invariably lose every single time.
It's like the first time I played Monopoly with my wife when we were dating, she wanted to trade me a donut for Reading Railroad, and I said no. So she threw the game at me. And I'm like, see, that's not playing fair. That's a small loser. Yeah. While I do like donuts, it doesn't help with gameplay.
I do have to admit that I was a sore loser the other day. We had opened up a new game, and I hated it within 2 seconds. It's, I don't even remember. It's called, it might have actually been a Steve Jackson game. It's an instant play system where everybody is acting at the same time. Huh. It was like a King Arthur sort of premise where you're trying to get... There's multiple Arthurs. They're all trying to pull the Sword Other Stone because they've heard the legend. But there's also multiple Merlins and multiple Lancelots, and everybody's trying to get the sword. They're all acting at exactly the same point in time. I could not keep track of what was going on. You're passing around this turn card, but there's two of them. So when you have three people or even four people, it was insane. Hi. No, it's okay.
Come on, Emma. Get over here. Grab a chair.
It was the first time that I've ever been like completely, utterly tempted to.
Just to chuck again.
I was seconds away. But
have you ever played Diplomacy?
Yes. Sorry.
That's the closest I've seen to a fist fight in a board game. Is Diplomacy.
You see a lot of those at gaming conventions.
Oh, okay, so now might be a good time to introduce all of the people, right? So we have the very silent Arlie Sword.
Hey.
Who's not said anything. We have J.A. Pitts, who writes some books or something like this. Yeah, with Lesbian Blacksmith. The magic word, Lesbian Blacksmith.
Oh, my God.
That's an in-joke no one will get on the podcast. And Emma Newman.
Hi.
Yep. So...
Who also writes things?
She writes some stuff.
I record some stuff.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Right, I have a book that she's going to have to sign, possibly against her will, so...
How could it ever be against my will to sign one of my books? It's one of the author's favorite things to do.
Yeah, see, that's what I don't get. Some people, they walk up and say, would you mind signing your book? And I'm like, whoever says no?
Yeah.
Really, really
famous people. Why don't you sign it when it's printed and save us the trouble?
Right. Lazy. All right. There's only 10,000 copies in the first run or something.
Yeah. I know.
You don't have a life, right?
Nothing I need to do is more important than signing a book for you. So.
I'm glad that we finally agree on something.
So let's start with John first, because
sure.
We were here with him before. What have you done at WorldCon? How's your experience been? Best panel that you went to, if you went to any?
You know, to me, the best part of the WorldCon so far, panel-wise, has been the Hugos. I think this year, so I've been to several of the Hugo Awards, and I thought this year was really good. Paul Cornell kept it together, and I thought it was pretty funny.
There were a lot of jabs,
which I really liked, the little jabs at, like, the kerfluffles and fandom kind of stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. Also, very mean to the Smoffs, which made me happy.
Yeah, which I think is very appropriate at times, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was very good, so I liked that the most. But, you know, it was just hanging out and meeting new people, like Arlie, and hanging out with him. And, yeah, that was fun. What was the name of that party over the Eddie Bar?
Oh, yeah, Drinks with Authors.
Drinks with Authors party.
Yeah.
You were there?
Yeah.
We were looking for you.
We spent 45 minutes in line for alcohol, and then when I got there, they didn't have the only one thing that I'll drink.
I think we took them by surprise because we went in there several times before the convention started and it was so quiet and we were saying, you do realise there are probably going to be in the region of, you know, more than 100, probably more than 200 people here, and they were like, yeah. we put both of us on that night, and it's like, no, I don't think you appreciate.
Yeah, they needed some more experienced bartenders, I think.
Yeah. But they were lovely people.
Oh, they were very nice people, but you know, I watched them pour more alcohol on the floor than actually in glasses at one point. So I was like, well, that's
why I was very polite and just said, give me beer, and then you don't have to do anything.
Except for me, because I was like, oh yeah, that some bulldog thing's got Kahlua and whatever, yeah.
And that was hilarious because she kept having to look up what was in it, and I'm like,
this is your bar. You work here.
How do you not know this?
But no, that was a really fun event. And
sure.
It was good of Justin to put it on, for sure. And who else? Somebody else. Tells,
Mike Cole,
though, will tell you if he listens to us. He, of course, he's ever humble. Was like, I didn't do anything. I just showed up and, you know, was loud and boisterous. And I was like, well, that makes a party, so.
Well, who else was there? Alex? Django Alexander?
Django Wexler?
Was
he there?
He finally showed up.
Oh, he showed up later.
Yeah. A lot of people were there, authors. Like, Robin Hobb was there. We missed her. Cassandra Clark is with Angry Robot as well.
Yeah.
Gail Carriger was there at one point.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
But quite a lot of people.
It was very loud.
Stina Light? Yeah, it was really loud. We sat in a corner and cried.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's funny is, I mean, I went to the tour parties and the Bane parties and all that. And it's just like, I just don't understand the hotels. Do they not understand how many people are coming to these things?
The tour party was crushed, wasn't it? It was so tight.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're just hot and they pack the hallways. And it's good. You can see a lot of nice, cool people, but you can't actually talk to them. It's too bad.
You know what I liked about the Drinks with Authors, though? Is that they attempted to do some different things other than just crush everyone in a room and give them some drinks.
Yes,
like they had games, they had giveaways.
They had a giant D20 dice.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong with a giant D20 dice.
Yeah,
and they, and they had a guy going around making sure that people were rolling it, and you know.
Yeah, that was actually pretty fun. We didn't get to roll it, but we won bucks.
I got to roll it.
Did you win?
I won.
What did you kill?
Do you remember?
Got
a D20?
You were the 20? It was Justin. So he was like, you're a crappy wizard. Like level 2. And you're fighting something gigantic. And I was like, you know what? Screw you. And I rolled like an 18, so I was good. And happy. And I won a book.
I got to roll 4 times. And the lowest roll I needed was an 11. And I didn't win anything.
Yeah.
Aww.
I know, it's just sad.
You won this.
I did.
To come talk with
That's
us.
That's okay, but I own most of those books already, so.
That's a fair point.
Well, the nice thing was that he was... that they were doing a great job of incorporating the people that were there as fans with the authors. I mean, they were doing a good job of basically pairing people up and going, oh, look, here's the author that wrote the book that I'm giving you right now.
Sure.
Was Scott Lynch there?
He was.
He may have popped in for a bit.
He popped in and he popped out.
Yeah, he's been doing that all day, all weekend.
My friends Megan and Joey actually helped run it, too.
Did they?
Oh, yay.
Yes. Yep. Do you guys know them?
No.
And Megan is probably going to come out with a book soon, so.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Well.
It's just a matter of time.
Just a matter of time.
The last name on the podcast.
Yeah, what's the last name?
I don't know her last name. I only know, but her company is Blushy, BLUSHIE.com. She also makes handmade soaps. And she has a huge business. Like, she's a small business owner. So if you like soaps, go on her website.
Or chapstick.
Yeah, she was giving away chapstick.
Oh, I missed
that. Awesome.
Damn.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so, and Emma, you're some sort of author person.
Yeah, I'm some sort of author person. I'm a British author person. That's what sort of author I am.
You came all the way out here.
Oh, you made
He does, like, crap. Karate, though. Like
Taekwondo, yeah.
Yeah, he punches stuff.
I do. And kick them. See, Taekwondo is big on kicking.
Aren't you like a triple, quadruple black belt?
No, I'm a blue belt.
Oh.
My kids are black belts, which just works out. I just make them protect me. I'll run this way.
That's why he had kids. He needed bodyguards.
Right. You don't also have a black belt, do you, Emma?
Not in any kind of violent confrontation things, no.
But in tea?
In tea, I definitely do. I have all the belts in tea.
What kind of stuff do you write about?
I write urban fantasy.
Nice.
Oh, awesome.
Angry Robot books.
Say what?
For Angry Robot books.
Oh, great.
So it's very British, very quirky. It's kind of a bit like Downton Abbey, but with mad sorcerers and evil fairies and politics and
so Downton Abbey.
Talking gargoyles. Yeah, like you take Downton Abbey and then just kind of sprinkle lots and lots of fabulous weird things onto it.
Is it tongue in cheek or is it serious? Or
no, it's serious. It's written straight, okay. And there are some quite serious issues in it, like personal freedoms, human rights, feminism.
Nice,
sounds good.
Yes, there's a lot in there, really, and detective noir. So yeah.
Yeah, and you just had the book another book come out.
Yes,
recently.
So the first and the second books have come out very close together, yeah. And I've narrated the audiobooks for them as well.
Really?
Yeah, I'm an audiobook writer.
Oh, wow.
And the third book, All Is Fair, is coming out in a month in the US.
Yep, I think we're interviewing you about that book.
Ooh, are we? Yeah. Why don't I have a copy yet?
Because you're never on the show because you suck.
Yeah.
Are they available in the dealer's room with the angry robot
they
table?
Are. And if you're interested, I can give you a magic card that gives you a discount. So I can give you one right here, and then you can go to the dealer's room.
Angry Robot is full of little tricks to get people to buy stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
It's really clever.
Yeah.
No, actually, though, I respect it because, you know, they came prepared. They're like, we want people to buy products.
And so terrible location in the dealer's room.
But they make it happen.
But they've made
I've seen lines.
Yeah.
You know, the nice thing about it being in it's not quite in a terrible location because of the fact that everybody can go Angry Robot's back corner, and you will find it no matter what.
That's true. And
it's easily locatable.
Yeah, and I would even argue that they're not facing an opposite table. Like,
exactly.
They're the end of the line. So,
there's a lot of room in that corner.
It takes a little longer to get to them, but and
it's worth it.
But they're incredibly innovative, which is nice. But
they're pretty much the only dealer in there that I can afford to buy from.
Well, they do special deals.
Yeah, because like
you need financial aid.
No. Like I spent.
You do? Okay.
I spent about $100 at the Angry Robot table, but I got quite a bit of stuff for $100. Whereas
nice.
I could have gone to another table and spent $100 on like some collectibles.
Two books.
I'm like, I got two books for $100. I'm like, why would I do this?
Well,
right? That's not why I'm here. Like, I understand that there's like the collectors, but I feel like there's very little effort to kind of actually push merchandise to people who are like that are just the fans that are coming to like get some book signs.
There's two traditional booksellers in there that's selling new stuff, aren't not collectors.
Yeah.
If you
they're doing very badly letting me know they exist.
If you spend $100 at Angry Robot, you should at least spend 20 or 30 on a John Pitts book.
Actually, he has all my books.
Oh, great.
I have
good job.
He's a podcaster.
Speaking of which, when is your next book?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? Isn't that an outrage?
Is it done?
Book 4 is... I'm actually doing another pass on book 4 because my agent pointed out something that was really cool. But I'm waiting to hear from Tor if they're going to pick up the next contract or not.
God, I hope so.
It's all
crossed fingers
and toes.
Really. I'm majorly doing it because I'm madly in love with Tom, so...
Book 4 is done, except for the final pass.
I think we might have to.
All right.
We'll do a thumb war.
roll a big 20-sided die.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I also have rolled book 5 already.
Oh my goodness.
Wow, so you're really going at it.
I am. I want them to...
Anytime you want to send those down to me so I can pre-read them for you.
I'll think about that.
Excellent.
I will happily do so.
Okay.
So if you're doing similar to Downton Abbey, is it like that sort of period, like the post-Victorian?
Earlier. Well, it's slightly more complex than that in that it deals with kind of three layers of reality. There's the real world, where there's no magic. It's just like our world.
Yeah.
And it's called the Split World series, and the worlds have been split between the real world and Exilium, which is the Fae prison. And in between the two is the Nether. And that's where there is a society of people who are effectively, they're human beings, but they're controlled by the Fae in like dynastic feuding families. And in the Nether, nobody ages. So there are people who were born 600 years ago.
Oh, interesting.
And so they have a very bizarre society in that they have several layers of history that live together, they coexist. And so the first book is set in Bath, but also the Nether reflection, which is called Ac Vaesulis, which is more like Regency Bath. And so there's modern day and period at the same time.
Nice.
And it's the juxtaposition of the two kind of ways of life, and one of the central characters, Kathy, who's tried to run away from the Nether and is dragged back in the first book, to kind of highlight the differences in the personal freedoms that we have now and due to our families and all of these kind of things, which are explored in different ways. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's
exciting.
Yeah. You know, this is my first WorldCon, and I have to tell you guys, like, what's really interesting about it for me, like, hearing you talk about your book, hearing John talk about his book, I've met authors here, and in talking with them about their books, I'm, like, really interested in reading it all of a sudden. And it's so much better than, like, going to a bookstore and trying to pick out, like, okay, the cover excites me, but the back doesn't or whatever.
Right. Or going, like, to Amazon, it's just, like, yeah, kind of stilted emotionally.
Yeah, like, Emma, I really, like, I'm genuinely interested in reading your book. I want to read John's books. It's crazy.
You realize how passionate the authors are about what they're writing and, when you get to meet guys.
Yeah, and how interesting the ideas sound, too, you know?
I mean, whether or not they're successful in the end, it doesn't matter.
Who
because
cares?
You want to read the book, and which means you're going to buy it. So,
sure.
And I think that's part of the reason that we've done the podcast, is that...
You get to talk to John.
We get to talk to John
awesome.
And Emma, and we get to feel the passion and hopefully convey it to people who listen to us, which is only like six people, but...
Hello, you lovely, beautiful six people.
They're amazing, aren't they?
So Emma's told us a bit about her books, and obviously we've already heard John's spiel, but we haven't heard it from the podcast. So tell us a bit. I mean, they've listened to episodes where he interviewed you, but kind of tell us where the series has been so far, and since you've mentioned there's the fourth book, which is now in, like, its hopefully last revision, is going to be coming. So give us a sense of where it's going now.
Well, the books they're set in Seattle, and they're about... based on Norse mythology, and my main character is a young blacksmith, 27-year-old Sarah Bohall, who also happens to be a lesbian, and the first book is really the coming out book. But bad things are happening, of course, in the world, because all the major cities are run by dragons, and there's necromancers and giants and trolls and all kinds of bad things. So by the time you get to the third book, there's dragon battles and helicopters.
Dragons and helicopters.
It really is. I cannot wait for this book to be made into a movie.
Me
just
too.
So I oh my god.
Yeah.
But it would be so meta, because in the first book there's actually the whole movie set, and she's building
props
for them.
Exactly, and that's what makes it genius. I mean, it is. The first book would be the best movie ever made, in my opinion.
I agree. And what I
very modest.
What I know is who should play Sarah in the movie.
Oh my god.
Oh, who?
That's tough.
Starbuck.
Katie Sackhoff.
Katie Sackhoff.
She's in Longmire right now.
She is in Longmire, but we could steal her from Longmire and have her be in this movie.
I love her.
She would be an awesome Sarah Bohall.
Bionic Woman was unfortunate, though.
Well, we won't talk about that.
In that
sub. But anyway, as more of the world starts becoming public to the at least to the crew in the novel, and they find out just how deep and insidious all the stuff is going on, things are ramping up pretty hard. I got a call from my agent at one point. She's reading partway through the book, and she just dropped the book and called me and says, "I don't know where you're going with this, but here's a list of people you're not allowed to kill."
Don't tell anyone that list.
Not at all. But it made me feel really happy.
He's almost as big of a jerk as George R.R. Martin, by the way. Almost. He's getting there.
Not quite.
He's a little bit some pages.
Nicer about killing people.
Well, you know, in a lot of fantasy books,
I cried,
it's like
more.
You get stabbed with a 30-inch blade, and the next day you're off getting coffee. In my world, if you get injured, you're really injured, and people really die, and bad things happen.
When you have a cast of characters that you can both like, but that you don't have that, you know, that you know there's a possibility of them really getting hurt. For me, it makes it more exciting and interesting, because you really don't know.
We went to a combat panel, which you should have been on, except that it was all women, which was really kind of epic, riding combat. And, you know, they talked a lot about it, you know, the emotional investment. I mean, if you have a character that literally just, drinks healing potion, is fine the next day, then there's never the danger, there's never the threat.
That's a role-playing game. If you have a GM that never, ever, ever kills the characters.
Exactly. Right. Which is awesome when you're 12, though. But after that, it just kind of
The only thing I would say is something we had mentioned when we were talking to Joss Voigt, where if you're going to do something like that where your character can heal like the next day and is like hunky dory,
there have to be
repercussions in the head.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because like even Wolverine doesn't like get, you know, he doesn't just run around and get stabbed and he's like, yeah, let's go get beer and have a nice day. Right. No, he's messed up. He has a history and all the stuff that happens to him. You know, he loses people that aren't like him.
Yeah.
You know, he goes through all these horrible experiences. He gets experimented on. All this shit happens to him. Yeah. And he has to deal with the consequences in his head.
Right.
He's also a psycho, but that's... You know.
I say John is just as much of an asshole, excuse my language, as George R. R. Martin. But honestly, I'm glad you kill characters. Because there's so much more emotional impact.
Yeah.
Then you're going to love the next book.
Okay. I won't.
Man.
I will probably sob my way through the whole thing. I cried like a little baby at certain points reading his book.
Because he does... There's some people that...
Ugly.
You won't say anything
ugly
more than
crying.
That.
I was probably about to cut my period, though, so, you know.
Oh, my God. Shit.
I didn't say it. It's all good.
Exactly. Right.
So how did that go for you?
It's not...
Wow.
Just kidding.
Oh, earning that explicit tag.
But it's also a lot of fun.
You get more
listeners. One of the most successful things I think about John's books is the fact that you incorporated, well, to me, and maybe it's just because I'm a big nerd, but the SCA component of it really is brilliant. The fact that I haven't seen that in any other fantasy, I'm still like, why isn't that everywhere?
Especially in urban fantasy. It
especially
would make more
in
sense,
urban
yeah.
fantasy. And it's just kind of ignored as something. Those people
sure.
don't exist.
But. You know, what? When I decided I was going to do that, what I wanted to be really careful for, because I'm an old D&D geek. I mean,
right.
I played D&D back before there were hardback books.
Oh, wow.
I mean, so, the I mean, I've been box. Playing for a long time, and what I definitely wanted to, I didn't want people to go, oh, this is his D&D campaign.
Right.
Right? Because it's totally not. And I wanted it to be realistic, but I mean, think about it. It's modern day Seattle, and I have to have people fighting with swords. There's a group of people who knows how to do that.
There are people who do that. And that was actually in the writing combat panel, they mentioned that as seriously, there's two different groups that can do sword fighting. The SCA is the one that will hurt.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool to hear, and mad props to the SCA right now. I'm not a member, but...
You know, it's interesting. There's a group, they're doing Western martial arts now, which is coming out of Western Europe and teaching sword fighting from the day when they really did sword fighting, which
right.
is slightly different tact on it than the SCA are doing.
Yeah.
So knowing some people who do that also didn't hurt.
And
yeah.
You know who should play Sarah? Is the woman who just won the longsword
yeah,
fighting
Samantha,
competition
Samantha
in earlier this year?
Yeah.
Because she looks exactly
she's
right.
New
That's
Zealand,
exactly how I picture her.
She's a New Zealander, isn't she?
I don't know.
I don't remember, but I've had three people send me her picture.
Oh, my
and
God.
Number one, it's just hot. I mean, she's just
right.
beautiful.
She's gorgeous, yeah.
Which makes me want to go back and maybe have Sarah wear some different armor.
Yeah, and that armor is practical armor, by the way. The armor
much.
She wears, there's a video where you can actually, she shows you close up the nicks that are in the armor. And, of course, what she tells you is that the armor is not for stopping blows from piercing. It's deflecting blows. Because if somebody is stabbing like this, you're effed anyway.
You're still going there. You know, so I spent, I got to San Antonio on the 23rd mm-hmm. because I went to Austin and met one of my fans as a blacksmith. And I got to go hang out at his blacksmithy, him
nice.
and the two guys he works with. And we talked a lot about this. And one of the things they told me, which I really hadn't realized before, is I have Sarah wear chainmail frequently. Because chainmail's less expensive,
right.
but it's also heavier.
Very, very,
true.
Very heavy.
And the fact that she now has access to the SCA folks, and she's a blacksmith herself, I'm thinking about changing her armor up a little bit. Just because, I mean, it would give me something else to play with.
Yeah,
but the whole weight factor is going to be really important, especially when you're, you know, riding a motorcycle or whatever. You know, that weight is a
right,
and doing
yeah.
crazy things on it.
Well, granted, she's probably you're talking about a motorcycle. Gear is not exactly one of the lightest things on it either.
Yeah.
If you're wearing good gear,
sure, sure.
Yeah. But anyway,
or in a college town where you just wear a t-shirt,
back to Emma,
no
though,
helmet.
Is you get you have you know research right there. You've got blacksmiths,
mm-hmm.
you can FCA that you can go to. Regency, England's not exactly an easily accessible atmosphere.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I live about half an hour from Bath. So
oh,
that's the
so
location
beautiful.
Of the first book. It's beautiful, and so I can go there physically, walk around. find really good resources that are trustworthy from the people who run and maintain the buildings. Like the assembly rooms in Bath are open to the public, and there's a major scene in the book set in the assembly rooms. So not only could I go there and walk around and write down all of the details to make it realistic in the book, sure, but there are source materials in their gift shop, for example, about the history of the rooms, but by extension the social history of the city, which very much influenced how the Fae Touched, is what they're called, these families, live in the Nether. So it is easy, and there are different kind of time periods that are drawn from. Londinium is a different social structure again, and the third book is set in Oxford and Oxenford, which is the reflection of Oxford, and that was very much influenced by when I lived there. I studied at Oxford, and I deliberately made Oxenford in the books much more progressive as a kind of a poke in the eye at how unprogressive the University of Oxford is, and how, you know, they really, really don't treat their students like anything other than an inconvenience, and I wanted to completely flip it around. So the way that the physical places are feeds into it a lot, and I've spent hours walking around, and I'm one of those location detail nerds, mm-hmm. So I'll go and take pictures. And the gargoyle in the book, someone tweeted to say, I went to St. Pancras Station and I couldn't see the gargoyle. What's that about? And I was like, okay, right, this is exactly where the gargoyle is. And here is a photo of the gargoyle. And there are actually about 12 on this tower. He needs just one of them. And, you know, they went back 3 days later and they're like, I found the gargoyle, in caps. And it was great. And I was like, I am so pleased, because I felt kind of like I'd let someone down. Like, no, really, this is all accurate.
Yeah, and I suppose
really,
like,
you can see the magic. Yeah.
Like some of the, I mean, most of the cities and towns in England, I mean, a lot of those buildings have been there since, you know, hundreds of years. So there is a sense, even
that
from a geographical perspective, you know, you can actually figure where things are. It's not like with, you know, ancient cultures where we're like, where the hell did they keep anything? I don't know. Like, there's a wall thingy over there. Maybe they had a hut.
Exactly. I think one of the most interesting things to me, just as a fan, and I don't write, but is learning how much each individual author, how much research they do. Because, of course, you always hear the mantra, you know, write what you know, which is, as far as I can tell, complete bullshit, because it's actually write what you go out and learn. Because the amount of research that people put into things is...
It's kind of more like write what you're fascinated by.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because if you're fascinated by it, then you can invest a lot of time looking into it, and then you can really embed that into your writing.
There was a bit of research I came across for the second book when I was looking very closely at Regency mealtimes and table manners, because one of the families in that bit of politicking had a dinner party that was a crucible dinner party, and there was all kinds of other stuff going on underneath. But I wanted all of the details to be correct, and I stumbled across this article about how they used to have, in drawing rooms and, you know, just in rooms in the house, they used to have cupboards which had a chamber pot inside that the gentlemen would just go over and piss into partway through the evening as their friends were there smoking cigars and things. And so I thought, that is so
bizarre. They should bring
that back. Yeah, it's so weird.
That would be so much easier.
Yeah, just me. You didn't have to go off anywhere. You're just like, oh, yeah, that was me.
Yeah, I'm listening. Keep talking.
Yeah, exactly. What's wrong? Oh, can you imagine the games they would play? Anyway, I thought, this is something that has
is
to
that,
go in
that'll
this
be
book.
In your next book.
No, it's in it. That's,
actual,
in, that's in the second
games
book.
Games too?
No, this, okay, the, no that's just, not the games, but no.
Early
games in the second book. That was something that I thought, once you find something like that, you have to write the scene around it so the research can actually feed in. And it made a great comment about one of the characters who was just awful, standing up and being highly offensive whilst he's peeing. And, yeah,
oh my goodness.
It made me happy.
I love that.
That's
great
going
detail.
In John's next book.
Oh. Well, when you do research, you find all sorts of weird things that nobody knows, but they were like common things that people would do. So, I mean, that is an example.
There's something that happened that was really exciting this weekend was that Mary Robinette Coyle ran a shadow puppet theatre.
Oh, cool.
And we got to make shadow puppets, and it was just the best thing ever. And I'm just such a huge, huge fan of her. And she was talking about the history involved. And I went up to her afterwards and I said, do you mind if I just entirely steal this idea of having shadow puppets? Because this would work so well in the split world, so I'm sure that they could do something to torment people.
For 30 seconds. Thank you.
It would be great to have that in the book. So she's like, yeah, cool. So things that you don't necessarily look to research.
Sure.
Then also get incorporated in because it just fits.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you never know what you're going to find and put in there.
Yeah. You know, it's funny for me on the research stuff. I mean, I like to go to those places that I'm going to write about.
Yeah.
But Google Maps, where you can get right down in Street View.
Oh, thank goodness it's Street View.
But I've had people who've written me and said, you know, where is that coffee shop in your book? Because I want to go there and get coffee. And a lot of the places in my books I make up. I mean, there's coffee shops everywhere, but I just make up the ones I want to do because I don't want to support necessarily the big, I wanted the indie ones, right?
Sure.
And there's people, I get letters that says, oh, I love that restaurant that you mentioned in the book. It's like, great, awesome, I'm glad you love it. I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, you
know. They're making stuff up and you're like, yeah, this place doesn't exist. What would be weird is if you found out the place actually exists and it's exactly how you describe it, but you've never been there, didn't know. It'd be really weird.
But with doing the research, I've done a lot of research on blacksmiths, and YouTube is your friend because you can watch people make things. But going to see blacksmiths doing it live, you get another level of detail that you just don't get even from reading the books or whatever. But my favorite, as soon as Black Blade Blues came out, I got letters from three different blacksmiths. Would you like to know what you got wrong in the book type of things? And they all disagreed with each other.
Oh my goodness.
So it's like, okay, I'm good enough.
If they can't even agree on what you did wrong, maybe you got it right.
That's good enough.
Yeah.
I think you always have to be careful, though, that when you really get into something and you research and you research and you research, is to only cherry pick, only to put like the top 1% of the iceberg into the book. So it just doesn't all get bogged down. There are a zillion things, and so many bits of backstory and so much of the history of the Split Worlds that will never reach the books because they were just bogged down the story.
Right.
And that's something which I think you really have to keep reins on when you get really excited.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what second drafts were for me. Cut that out.
That's one of those things that I've always just wanted to kind of step into authors' rooms, just to take pictures of sort of their mapping out space. And I know not everybody does it the same way. Some might just have a notepad sitting there with a couple of scribbled notes. And then you have other people who literally have the sort of crime scene narrative tacked up to the wall. How do you do it?
It depends. It depends on the stage that I'm working at. So with the Split Worlds novels, there are four different POVs, and there are different power factions in society, different political struggles. There are power factions within factions and fights, so it's complex. So what I tend to do is to have a big, big brainstorm and then start to tease out key elements, plot-level elements. And then I'll have a very, very large piece of card, and I'll divide it into plot, like threads, and put them together and then start to draw lines between where they intersect and where they're going to align in terms of time. And then from that I write down like a brief bullet point description of the next five chapters, and then I write them and then I reevaluate. And it's what I call like the agile way of doing a book. So it's kind of pantsing but also outlining. So I don't know every detail, and if things change, that's fine. Then I go back and say, okay, something's changed here. Does that still fit with the original conception? No, it doesn't, but I like it, so I'll change it. It's a two-way process back and forth between sticking to the plan, but then also feeling free to reach out from it.
Right, sorry, that was me. How about you, John?
What's your process?
That's funny. I'm a tech geek, so I do mine in Excel.
Right.
So I do almost the same thing. So I put the chapters across the top, and the plot points down the first set of columns, and then all my characters down. And then I put an X in the column if that plot point is being discussed or impacting that scene. And then which character has the point of view, because it's mainly single point of view, first person, but I have occasional third person points of view from other characters. And then so I say who has the point of view and who's in the scene and who's mentioned in the scene. And then to me it's really good because I outline the whole novel first. I never stick to the outline. I always end up going off of it, but I always start with an outline. And then I can go through and I take the outline and go back to my novel map and fill in everything. And then I see, oh, look, this character disappeared for 33 chapters. Maybe I should do something with them somewhere in here. You know? And that really helps me keep track of who's going where. Because I also have to say is, well, this is on Saturday and this is on Sunday, and here's where the full moon is, because most months you can't have three full moons, which I did in my first novel. So I had to go back and fix all that.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Whoops. Well, you know, if you're running around at night, it's easier to see if there's a full moon. But if you've already done that, you can't do it again later. So that's what I do. And that helps me keep track of things. And I've got another spreadsheet where I keep all my characters, because what I've learned in writing a series is you can't change people's names and eye color and height and birthdays and favorite foods or whatever. So I have to keep a log of all my characters and all the important facts about them, like how tall they are.
Yeah.
This can be important sometimes, especially if you're in a fight, right? So,
yeah.
And I constantly go back to that stuff. And copy editors are awesome with that, because they went through my novels and they talk about, here's the first time this character's been introduced, here, the chapter, you know, here's the first time this building or this factory, whatever, has been introduced. And I use that to update my list in case I miss something.
Yeah. I've been experimenting with making a wiki. Because I have several families who have several generations of people within them, and their names are quite complex. So I've started a wiki, and I'm fairly good at it, but I get bored really quickly because I just want to write the bloody book. So I've got very, very patchy information, and I really wish I could do that, but this is so dull.
So here's the trick for you. My friend Ken Scholes, who I think you guys talked to Ken, he's got a very complex book series, and he has a fan who maintains a wiki for him.
Yeah, George R. R. Martin has that too.
Exactly.
A Finnish fan, I think, actually.
Yeah.
You just find some random person who's madly in love with you and you make them do it.
That just seems unethical.
You know what? They love to do it.
They love to do it.
And they give them a copy of the book. I'll send them an autographed copy of the book, and they're just...
I imagine that every author has their sort of rules nerd. You know, that will be picking it apart no matter what. They're in love with the books, but they still have to break it down into the nitty-gritty little pieces and be like, oh my god, that doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, George R. R. Martin has the I don't remember the fellow's name, but he's got this guy who basically just like keeps a track of every freaking thing. And so anytime George R. R. Martin's like, he said this in interviews, he's like, I can't remember what color eyes this guy had, and so he'll call up the guy and be like, what kind of eyes did he have? He's like, oh, is that color? Good, okay. So he can keep everything in track. I mean, with George R. R. Martin, he's got like 8 billion characters in every book, so it can get complicated.
I think that, you know, if you have a fan who enjoys your writing and enjoys doing that sort of thing, and they're excited and interested in it, and they would love to do it for you, then there's no way it can be unethical.
Exactly.
You know, they would love to engage with you on that level, and there are definitely people like that. You know?
Right. Mm-hmm. They already have the emotional investment in the series, and this just gives them that much of an extra connection.
Well, yeah, they get to be involved with something that they love.
Yeah.
Well, if you're listening, then please do come and find me.
Contact Emma Newman at... We'll give you the website.
Come find her in a public space with lots of other people around.
I want to make a wiki.
No, don't, because I blush horribly.
I won't mention China.
Oh no!
Mentioned China.
That was mean. That was more than
usual. I'm sorry.
Oh dear.
So okay, so John. Yes. So you probably don't have a rough publication date for this new book.
No.
No, I don't.
We're going to have to make that change.
We're very angry about that.
We're going to go yell at Tor for you.
Give him a deadline.
Do that.
Our ninjas will attack the Tor offices and force them to...
What they need to do is buy more copies of Forged in Fire. Because as more people buy copies of that, the odds of them buying the next contract go up.
Okay. Buy 50 billion copies.
It's worth it. It's worth every single penny that you will spend on it.
And I got to tell you, it's one of the best covers I've seen. I gotta give a shout out to my cover artist, Daniel DeSantos, who's on the Hugo list this year.
Right. Oh my god.
He is phenomenal.
Agreed. I voted for him. He was my number one.
He gets the work, you know? And what I find fascinating is he likes my book so much he does my covers in oils.
Ooh.
First. And I actually called him and said, so what's it gonna take for me to buy the original for the first book? And he said, well, you can't, because it's hanging in my living room, and my wife says I'm not allowed to sell it. So there you go.
That's awesome. So where can people find you?
My website, japitts.net. And if you like my stuff, I do have a short story collection coming out in November from Fairwood Press.
I'll
be blogging about that as soon as I get a date. We're going to launch it at Oricon, which is the Portland... convention coming up in November.
Oh, excellent. Wow. And Fairwood's actually quite good. They're a nice small press. They do lots of collections.
They do. Yeah. Fairwood, they do really nice work.
Yeah, they've absolutely done. I've read some of the collections.
One of their covers was up for the Chelsea this year.
Really?
Yeah.
Good
work. Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good work. Excellent. And Emma, where can people find you?
Well, my kind of personal website is enewman.co.uk, and my podcast, Tea and Jeopardy, is a kind of a subset of that, and that can be found at teaandjeopardy.com. And there's also a Split Worlds website, which is splitworlds.com, all with the W's in front, but it just seems silly to say that these days.
It is, it's a little silly. But, and Arlie, do you have a website? And
I do.
Tell us.
ArlieSorg.com, ArlieSorg.com.
Right. And do you have stuff that, like, what do you do on there?
I have, well, you know, I have a blog. I have also published 4 short stories.
Excellent.
So I'm coming out, you know, in more ways than one.
You and I are like kindred.
Yay!
Hey, high five.
Yeah, I have some shorts and some really cool small press magazines. And, you know, we all need to support the good small press magazines.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that way that semi-prozine doesn't just become the same 5 names forever.
Yeah, and that's how the magazines come up, too, is like from people going and supporting them. I have the cover of Big Pulp, and I have one coming out in SQ Mag, and a really, really cool mag called The Future Fire.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. By Jabril.
Yep.
I'm going to butcher the name, so I'll just stop. He knows who he is. Yeah.
Yes.
And they just did We Are... They did an anthology of not Western-themed. I think it was, like, African-themed fiction. We Are... The different future. I totally butchered the name.
But you're going to be in contact with them for our
right because we're going to be getting a copy. I'll put a link in the show notes for it because I'm totally just blanked on the title off the top of my head. But yeah, a really cool anthology edited with Fabio Fernandez.
Yeah.
So,
and it's really important to support magazines like The Future Fire because they're small and they are very interested in publishing authors and stories from different backgrounds about different topics and addressing different sorts of issues that a lot of mainstream publications don't address.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And they tend to have a little bit more, like, they like to push the envelope a little bit more
than
the smaller places.
Yeah.
Clarkswood, I think, is maybe one of the few exceptions of the big, big, big guys, at least big guys in terms of paying you $5 billion for a story, since they pay pretty well.
Yeah,
but
Strange Horizons.
They do too, yeah, from time to time, yeah. Okay, so we're going to stop ourselves. So thank you, John, for joining us, coming and talking to us. Yeah. Thank you, Emma.
And thank you, Arlie.
And thank you, Arlie. You weren't originally planned, but hey, come on, it's good stuff.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.